Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Russell Frackman. I represent the appellant, UMG Recordings, Inc. If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. I start with the proposition, Your Honors, that our case is actually a very narrow and specific case. It deals with a non-commercial transaction, not a retail sale to a consumer. Does not deal with the millions of recorded copies of music that are sold to consumers that are subject to the first sale doctrine, but rather to a very limited number of specific CDs, product that is different in form and in function, and indeed in distribution method from commercial CDs. So what we are asking the court to do today is to examine not the overall structure of the sale of recorded music, but simply this very narrow situation in which recorded music is provided to a small segment of the industry for purposes, as Your Honors know, for review, and in order to get the word out, frankly, to the consumer.
Well, you'll probably notice today that we've got three cases on today that are what we call are batched. I mean, they aren't exactly the same cases, but they involve a lot of the same issues, and they're at different places on the spectrum. And it seems to me you do say that you have a narrow issue, but you send these out to people, and people don't ask for them, right?
No, to the contrary, Your Honor. These are sent out to people who
are going to give you free advertising.
Well, who are going to do their business, who are going to do their work. A DJ can't play a record without a promotional CD before the release of the commercial CD. A record reviewer can't write a review without a promotional CD. It is of mutual benefit, certainly.
But do you have actual requests for them from each person that you send them to?
We have, over the years, people are added to our lists through custom and practice. Everybody in the industry knows about it.
Now, the declaration that was submitted, I don't remember the name of the woman who submitted it, suggested that it was employees of UMG or of their consultants who were creating these lists and didn't suggest at all that there were any express, written, or even oral requests for them. That wasn't in the declaration. So help me understand why this isn't a gift under either the federal or the state postal act.
Well, Your Honor, the district court referred to the Federal Postal Act, as Your Honor mentions. The reason is not a gift. There are several reasons, but the main reason is that in the 40 years that the Postal Act has been in effect, it has never applied to a situation like this. We know the district court did not cite the legislative history, but we know the reason for the Postal Act. It is Congress and the courts, and this court, in fact, in the Kipperman case, I believe, referred to as the pernicious activity. It is a Consumer Protection Act, Consumer Fraud Act. It dealt with the situation where product was delivered without notice to consumers, everyday consumers, and then they were dunned. Their credit was threatened.
You rely on the legislative history, what the original intent was, but the plain language of that statute, I find it difficult to get around.
Well, Your Honor, I have a couple of responses to that. The plain language of the statute in various places, including in particularly the word merchandise, I would submit is ambiguous.
So you're saying the CDs are not merchandise?
Promotional CDs
are not merchandise.
In the context of this case, are not merchandise. They're not provided by a merchant. They're not sold, which is a typical definition of merchandise.
Under the Postal Act, it says it can be deemed a gift. Does the recipient have to do something to deem it to be a gift?
Well, Your Honor, That's a good question, and I think the answer is the cases have not confronted that issue because, and I think it's very important that the statute says may be deemed a gift. The recipient may deem it a gift. He or she does not have to, and it is not, in my view, automatically. Part of the problem we have here, of course, is that in every case brought under the Act, as far as I know, it was an original recipient who brought the case. That's not what we have here.
Does that matter, though? I mean, if, in fact, the recipient thought he could dispose of it by whatever means that it was a gift, then he becomes the owner under state law, it would appear, which would then allow the next person who gets it to have the rights of an owner.
Well, Your Honor, it does matter. Matters for a couple of reasons. Number one, I would submit that recipient in the context of the statute means a consumer, Mr. Augusto is not in the hands of, in the shoes, I should say, of a consumer.
But the first recipient, is your argument that the first recipient of it is not a consumer?
The first recipient of a promotional CD in this context is not a consumer.
And why is that?
Because a consumer goes out and into the marketplace generally purchases a product for consumption. And this is something that's given for free to a limited number of individuals who are in the business.
Now, but the statute just says recipient, right? It doesn't have the word.
The statute says recipient, but it doesn't define what a recipient is.
Well, but isn't that a... Oh, go ahead.
I have another response to...
Plain language recipient is someone that receives something.
And indeed, Mr. Augusto did not receive it. Somebody else received it. We don't know the context, if I can answer your question further, Your Honor. Since Mr. Augusto could not or would not tell us where he got these promotional CDs that are the subject of the lawsuit, we don't know where he got them. We don't know whether the original recipient may have lost them. We don't know whether they may have been stolen someplace.
Now, I was trying to understand the burden of proof in civil cases on who has the burden of showing the first sale doctrine. And maybe you could provide us some information on that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it an open question in our circuit?
No, I don't think it's an open question. I think Congress has answered that in the legislative history to Section 109.
Okay, but if we're plain language people that we don't look at legislative history, then it makes it an open... There isn't a case out there that says the burden of proof goes to the person that claims the first sale document, right? Is there a case out there?
Yes, there are, Your Honor, including the Wise case, which at least by implication talks about that, and the...
That put the government to the burden of proof, right? That was a criminal case.
And that's
so do we have a civil case?
That's the distinction that the court drew, that this court drew in Wise, that the government has the burden of proof of proving an absence of a first sale. There are a number of district court opinions, of course, that have so held. There's no case that has held the other way, and it is an affirmative defense. There's no dispute that it is an affirmative defense to a claim for copyright infringement, which is exactly how it was raised here. And there is nothing in the statute or otherwise that would flip the burden of proof that normally applies to an affirmative defense. And I would submit, Judge Callahan, the statute itself does not say, there's no plain language in the statute as to who has the burden of proof, but the legislative history that we quoted in our brief is absolutely clear on that.
Well, it always seems to me sometimes when we need to talk about this so long and two sides have different stories about it, you know, then maybe someone needs to say it in an opinion who has the burden of proof. Because if someone said it in an opinion, then we wouldn't have to talk about it so long. So what's clear to the parties in terms of how they fashioned it and their argument, sometimes maybe it, you know, hasn't been said.
Your Honor, I would submit that there's no dispute on who has the burden of proof. They claim that they have fulfilled their burden, not that they don't have the burden. And I would suggest that they have not, because they haven't kept records. They haven't told us where any of the particular.
So if we accept your view of that you create a relationship with people by just sending something that they never even asked for, if they give it to Goodwill, have they committed a violation?
Your Honor, yes, they must keep it in their personal possession. That is what the.
So even though I didn't ask for something and you send it, because there are going to be some, even if I accept some of your argument, that there still are going to be people out there that didn't ask for it. So I get something in the mail that now I have a relationship with someone that I never even asked for this, and well, they can tell me what to do with it.
You've accepted that relationship under the law of this court, including in the Wall Data case that has approved shrink wrap licenses in the context.
Well, there's somebody went and bought the copyrighted disc, right? So I don't know that we've directly addressed the question of whether shrink wrap and click-through licenses create a license relationship, but here there was nothing like that.
Well, I would suggest to Your Honor, Judge Ikuda, that if it is enforceable in a shrink wrap license where somebody goes into a store, pays money, and walks out thinking that they've made a sale, it certainly ought to be enforceable in the context of the limited situation that we're dealing with here, where on the face of the CD, it says that acceptance is agreement, and it spells out the license terms. It does everything that this court in Wall Data has suggested needs to be done in order for there to be a license.
You might want to, you're looking at 3 minutes, but if Judge Candy has a question.
How do you as sender know that the recipient accepts the license?
They keep it, Your Honor. They can send it back, and there are promotional CDs that are sent back. They retain it.
So just by retaining it, they accept the license?
Just as in a software situation. Okay. They retain it, and presumably they use it, but they retain it for their own business purposes.
Do you want to save the balance of your time?
I do, Your Honor. Thank
you
very much.
Okay, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Joseph Gratz of Drury Tongari LLP in San Francisco. I represent Appellee Troy Augusto. Your Honors, the question before the Court today is this. Who owns this particular piece of plastic today? Is it my client, Mr. Augusto, who brought it at a used record store, or UMG, who sent it out to someone who did not ask, never asked for it back, never expected it back, and never desired its return? To make that determination, under this court's precedence, we look to the economic realities of the transaction that occurred between UMG and the initial recipient. And here, all of those economic realities line up. UMG, indeed, has no knowledge of any CD of this type ever having been returned. That's in the record at 1101, contrary to what Mr. Frackman said. UMG deducts these on its taxes as expenses, not as assets.
But does that matter? I mean, if in fact the first person who received it and it created a license between UMG and that person, then we've upheld that sort of creation of a license. And the opposing counsel is saying that by accepting and not returning that CD, the initial recipient created a license relationship with UMG. Why isn't that right?
The relationship between the UMG and the initial recipient may have resulted in a licensing contract on one hand, but that is not a mutually exclusive category with resulting in the transfer of ownership of a physical object. Those two things can happen in the very same transaction. And here,
the physical object is labeled all over itself.
The physical object does have a label, Your Honor, yes. It says for promotional use only, not for sale. But that is one, that is the form of the transaction. It's what's said in the agreement. And what this court said in the Atherton case and the Microsoft against DAC case is that we have to look beyond the form of the transaction to its substance. So here we need to look beyond what UMG said and look at what UMG did.
Well, have other cases applied the Postal Reorganization Act as a defense to copyright infringement? And if not, what's your best argument that we should do so here?
So other cases have not applied the Postal Reorganization Act directly in the copyright context, Your Honor. But the question here under the Copyright Act is one of the ownership of a physical object. That is what Section 109 says is the dispositive factor here. And when it comes to the question of who owns a particular physical object, there are numerous cases under Section 3009 that say that things that weren't asked for and for which there was no explicit prior consent or request are owned by the recipient and can be treated as a gift. And there's no question here that what's happened is the person who received the CD chose to treat it as a gift, sold it at a used record store.
How do we know that?
Well, Your Honor, we know that in this case because my client bought these CDs at used record stores.
Well, and what if they were stolen?
Well, Your Honor, we asked that. We asked UMG in a request for admission, request 112, were these CDs stolen?
Well, what if they were stolen from the person to whom they were sent?
There's nothing in the record that indicates that they were, and neither of the parties has presented any evidence that could be the case here.
So it does come back down to who has the burden of proof.
Well, Your Honor, the burden initially rests with us, with the party presenting the affirmative defense. But we have met that burden here by showing that the general practice of UMG in sending out these CDs was to send them out without consent or request, and that practice was followed in these cases. And for Mr. Augusto's part, that he purchased these CDs lawfully at used record stores in the Los Angeles area. And there's no indication that in between those anything else occurred. Indeed, this is the tradition in the music industry. This happens with great frequency, as the LA Weekly article that's cited in our briefs indicates, that it's well understood that many music reviewers don't lose or have stolen their CDs. They sell them at used record stores. And then people like Mr. Augusto purchase them, sometimes for further resale.
So is it your position that you bear the burden of proof to establish the first sale doctrine?
We certainly bear the burden of proof in the first instance, since we are advancing that affirmative defense. But we have met that here, first of all, by presenting evidence from our side of where we got the CDs, and then through discovery by showing what UMG's practices were, and in particular with respect to the CDs at issue here, that UMG followed those practices, that they mailed out these CDs to people they had decided themselves to mail them out to without the prior expressed request or consent of those recipients.
Do we have to decide who has the burden of proof on that issue in order to resolve this case?
Your Honors, I don't believe you do, if only because the evidence here, the undisputed evidence here, is so clear on the way that these CDs were treated. UMG has put a large amount of information in the record that is sufficient to show, in this case, exactly who owns the CDs, and the question of who owns the CDs, who owns the particular physical objects, is the dispositive question.
In your view, what would UMG have to do to have just a licensed release of CDs to disc jockeys and people like that?
Instead of transferring ownership, in order to make this a loan of a physical object rather than a transfer of a physical object, they could, for example, include a self-addressed stamped envelope so that the CDs could be returned. They could even include an address, perhaps, to which to send them. That might or might not show the necessary intent to get them back. But these CDs didn't even include include that. There's no place to send them. There's no way to send them there. And there's no indication that there will be consequences if they are not sent back.
But let me ask you this. Now, the argument is that there was a license agreement formed between UMG and the first recipient.
Yes,
do we consider whether there's a license or not? Is that a question of federal law or state law? Are we looking to state law on this?
The question of who owns the CDs, the question of where the ownership lies under Section 109, or rather whether there is no transfer of ownership and a mere loan of a physical object, is a question of federal law. And the reason for that was set out by the Second Circuit in the Krauss against TitleServe case.
I guess I'm not understanding your argument that a license, it's irrelevant whether a license was formed because this is a physical object. I don't think our cases have said it's irrelevant, but that, in fact, a license could require that the physical object be treated in a certain way or destroyed.
A licensing contract could require that an object be treated in a certain way, but the mere presence of a copyright license doesn't tell us anything by itself. The fact that an agreement is denominated a license does not tell us anything by itself about where the ownership lies. One has to look to the substance of the transaction, which includes, as Your Honor says, the terms of the particular license. And the terms of the notice here are simply for promotional use only, not for sale.
And so UMG argues that that creates a license. You're arguing, I assume, it does not. And so my question is, well, so what law governs our determination of was there a license?
The question, Your Honor, is not merely whether there was a license. As a number of courts have held, the categories of a license under a copyright and physical ownership both can exist at the same time. That's the holding of the Federal Circuit in the DSC Communications case. The question is whether this agreement, whether it's denominated a license or something else, prevents a transfer of ownership of the object. And there are some licensing agreements that certainly do that. Licensing agreements, for example, that require return after 1 year, as a number of the cited cases do, or that require ongoing payments. But here, this is not an agreement that prevents the transfer of ownership of this physical object.
You know, in Hampton, which is probably our earliest case, that there were all kinds of arguments made like this, that, well, they don't have to return it, they don't have to do this or that, and what we seem to have said in Hampton is, so what? This was framed as a license and that's that.
Yes, Your Honor. The Hampton case was about the ownership of a copyright and the ownership of a license to that copyright. That is, what acts that would be copyright infringement but for the license the person was able to perform. And in particular, whether the owner of the copy was able to make public performances in that case. Here, this case is not about ownership of a copyright or a license of a copyright. It's about ownership of a physical object or a loan or license of that physical object. And so that's why the Hampton case, while certainly the earliest precedent dealing with the question of license versus ownership, is about license versus ownership of a copyright rather than a copy.
Well, yeah, maybe you own the disk and they own what's written on it.
Indeed. And that is the question under the first sale doctrine. The question is who owns the disk?
Well, go ahead.
Well, try to use it without violating the copyright if they own what's written on it.
Indeed, Your Honor. But it is not copyright infringement, even without a license, to listen to a CD. Simply to put on headphones and listen to it oneself requires no copyright license at all. And that's why one doesn't receive a license when one purchases a CD at retail. And why we don't necessarily know that there was a copyright license here.
The language of their long form on the disk says that the CD is the property of the record company, is licensed for personal use, and resale or transfer of possession is not allowed. So the import of that language is that they are controlling the disk itself, not merely the copyrighted material on it. Why doesn't that create a contract or a contractual relationship with the first recipient?
The label on the CD, Your Honor, is an element of the form of the transaction. It certainly does say this CD is the property of the record company, is licensed to the intended recipient for personal use only, and so on. But this court's precedents, starting with Atherton and extending to DAC and further, indicate that we must look beyond the label given to the transaction and look beyond what the words that are printed on the label here, and look beyond what UMG said to what UMG did.
Well, there was the long and the short, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so some had the short and some had the long.
Yes.
Yet there was a stipulation between the parties that it means the same thing whether you have the long or the short. So how the long and the short to me don't exactly say the same thing, but we have a stipulation here, so I'm not really sure exactly what we do with that.
Your Honors, our understanding is that all of them mean the following and no more than the following: for promotional use only, not for sale. That is the beginning and the end of the purported license terms.
The one you just read said that we retain the property.
That's right, Your Honor. Some of them have a longer license, and we are of the view that the longer license is of no more import than the shorter license.
And theirs is that the shorter license is equal to the longer one.
Takes on the full import, I assume, of the longer one. Yes, Your Honor. So, Your Honors, I'd like to speak briefly, if I may, about the other independent basis for affirmance here, the Postal Reorganization Act, because it was the subject of so much discussion earlier. The section says, in no uncertain terms, that merchandise mailed without the prior expressed request or consent of the recipient is owned by that recipient.
So UMG says it's not merchandise. Promotional CDs are not merchandise.
Indeed, Your Honor. The argument appears to be these aren't merchandise because they're not being bought or sold. They're just free samples that are not subject to sale. But Section 3009A explicitly brings within the ambit of the statute free samples. So the question cannot be whether or not they're subject to sale. The question is whether they're subject to consumption. And here, how does one consume a CD? One consumes a CD by listening to it. And that is what the original recipients may have done. That's certainly what UMG intended that the original recipients do. So, Your Honors, in order to provide consumers with the certainty that they own the CDs they buy, we urge the court to hold that notwithstanding the label given to the transaction by UMG, Mr. Augusto owned the CDs he bought. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Right, you have 2.5 minutes.
Okay, I'll talk fast.
I'll
talk more.
Yeah. Just say it importantly. Yeah.
Let me make just a couple of points if I can. Our position is consistent, as Judge Canby may have alluded to, starting with Hampton, going through this court's opinion in Wise, which we've dissected in some detail in our brief. Where we are is very similar to the DVDs, the VIP DVDs that were in Wise, where wherever ownership was retained, the court affirmed the finding that there was a license. And
but why shouldn't we distinguish Wise here? Because unlike Wise, your CDs are unsolicited, and it's recipients do not clearly consent to the terms, like in Wise.
Well, yes, they do clearly consent to the terms, and there wasn't even a dispute below that there was an agreement formed. In fact, their argument is that we're limited to a contract. There was no dispute, and there couldn't be, I would submit, under Wall Data, among others, that there was an agreement formed. But if I can go, you go from Wise and the DVDs in Wise to this court's opinion in Wall Data. where the court said generally if the copyright owner makes it clear that she or he is granting only a license to the copy of software and imposes significant restrictions on the purchaser's ability to redistribute or transfer that copy, the purchaser is considered a licensee, not an owner. That's how this court distilled the law up through Hampton and Wise, and that is exactly what we have here.
Maybe you could answer the question that opposing counsel wouldn't answer for me, which is if your position is there was a license, a contract entered into between UMG and the first recipient, is that a question of state law? Do we look at state law for the scope of that license?
It is initially a question of state law, Your Honor, but this court has already determined, as have others, that those types of licenses are enforceable. Shrink wrap licenses, click through licenses, specific statement in wall data that it was enforceable. Because, of course, a contract can be accepted by conduct. If I can, just very briefly, I would submit to the court that what they are asking for is form over substance, not what we are asking for. And the proof of it is the answer to one of Your Honor's questions, which is what would we have to do? Put a return address on there. Well, that really is form over substance. There is a name of the record company, by the way, on there, and these people know who we are. The economic reality, if you will, here clearly favors us. It's a limited number to a select group, industry insiders who know what they're getting, who can see what they're getting before they accept it, for business purposes, who get them repeatedly, who get them for free. And it's not a commercial sale. It's not somebody walking out of a store buying software, putting his money down, walking back home, and then finding out that maybe there's a license. I don't have an opinion on that one, but I certainly have an opinion on our situation. This is not a consumer sale. It's done pre-release. It is for the benefit of the public.
Okay, wrap it up.
One more sentence. And under the first sale doctrine, we are consistent with the rationale of the first sale doctrine. We are not affecting the secondary market.
That's two sentences unless you put a semicolon there.
It's a run-on sentence, Your Honor. We are not affecting the resale market because there are millions of CDs out there that are sold used, and we are not attempting an end around the for sale doctrine.
All right. Thank you both for your helpful argument in this matter. This case will stand submitted.